RCMP Constable Nathan Wells joined the Mounties in 2000. He was assigned to the Coquitlam Street Enforcement Unit. His job as a rookie was to develop and nurture informants who had knowledge of district drug traffickers, although he had heard about the work that Inspector Don Adams' task force was doing regarding the missing women, he had not concerned himself with Adams' investigation until he met Dwayne Scott Chubb, a 30-something heroin addict. A year later, in the autumn of 2001, a longtime employee of the Pictons, Chubb, had worked intermediately for the two brothers, sometimes for the dump truck business and other times for the topsoil business from 1993 to 2001. In April 2000, following an assault outside the Coquitlam bar, Chubb sustained a head injury that required 160 stitches. According to Chubb, he had inadvertently led to his heroin problem. When his physician stopped prescribing morphine for his pain, he turned to heroin for the next few months. Afterwards, he entered a methadone program for heroin addicts, and during this period, he began talking to Wells. Chubb sometimes worked as a bagman of sorts for the area drug dealers, in which he picked up money for them. When they first began talking, Chubb had reportedly provided Wells with some information about drugs initially. However, during a subsequent cop informant meeting that occurred in the early 2002, Chubb took Wells down a different path. During a meeting on Friday, February 1st, 2002, Chubb told Wells about a firearm and ammunition that he's seen on Robert Picton's farm, dating about a year or two earlier. One of the firearms was illegal, a MAC-10 fully automatic handgun. Some of them were illegally stored in Picton's trailer, contrary to Canadian firearm laws, which required them to be kept under lock and key. The new information was enough to cause Wells to do a computer search of Robert Picton. After checking out Picton, Wells considered he might be in over his head. The computer search involving Picton turned up a note attached to electronic file advising anyone interested in Robert Picton to speak to the Vancouver police. Since the note was vague, Wells continued putting together information for the search warrant for the firearms, for which he would soon be applying through the court system. Before he can make much progress, however, a staff sergeant, Monday, February 4th, 2002, advised Wells to contact the Joint Missing Women's Task Force before proceeding any further. Wells did contact the task force, but initially told little aside from the fact that the task force knew about Picton. After being aware of Wells' inquiry, Wells did contact the task force, but was told little aside from the fact that the task force knew about Picton. After being aware of Wells' inquiry, Staff Sergeant Wayne Clary, the task force second in charge, informed Sergeant John Carter that he could speak with Wells if he so desired. Carter did, in fact, call Wells back and suggesting ways of how they might help each other during the search. There seemed to be little information at this point to suggest that the task force believed that anything significant pertaining to their case would turn up. The task force members seemed to be participating in an effort with a matter-of-fact attitude. Arrangements were made to get Wells the search warrant for the firearms at Robert Picton's farm, and the plans to execute the search warrant were coordinated with the task force with Carter's help. It was agreed that Carter and other members of the task force would attain the search, but they would do so only from the vantage point that it was not on the property itself. Their purpose, according to Wells, was to remain nearby with a police radio in event that Wells' search turned up anything that might pertain to the task force investigation. Based on the information contained in Wells' search warrant, the police would be looking for a MAC-10 fully automatic handgun, a .38 caliber handgun, and a .44 caliber handgun on Robert Picton's farm. On Tuesday evening, February 5th, 2002, Wells and three other Mounties, dressed in plain clothes, slowly made their way from their vehicles parked a short distance away towards Robert Picton, the rundown white trailer located on the north side of the farm. It was dark, it was cold, damp, as the police officers walking through the thick mud carrying a battering ram saw headlights in the distance and soon heard the sound of a vehicle approaching. It was heading towards a trailer. They stopped for a few moments, then proceeded after they heard the vehicle's door close, following a few moments later by the opening and closing of the trailer's door. Aware of the risk that the firearms inside the trailer posed, now that someone was there, the Mounties nonetheless gave the signal to proceed as planned. Wells and the other three officers walked onto the low deck, battering ram in hand, while other group of Mounties, which arrived separately, remained close by. It wasn't until the police cruiser, with its light flashing and its ear-piercing siren, sped up the muddy drive, the agreed-upon signal to assault the trailer, that Wells and his team shouted out, "Police, we are here serving a search warrant." Moments later, the cops used a battering ram to break open the front door. About the same time, Picton was headed down another door to see what was happening. Corporal Howard Liu was the first to confront Robert Picton, who was standing off to his left. He shouted, "Police, get down!" Picton immediately dropped to the floor. Apparently noticing Lou's gun drawn pointed at him, Liu carefully approached Picton and ordering him to keep his hands where he could see them. Picton, face down on the floor, Liu handcuffed him with hands behind his back, brought him up to his feet, and moments later placed him in a waiting police cruiser outside. The arrest went off without a hitch, quickly, without incident or resistance, and within a short time, Picton was driven off his farm and taken to the police station. The interior of the trailer was extremely filthy, consisted of six rooms. Each of the Mounties have gone inside and was assigned a section of it to search. Although Corporal James Petrovich has been instructed to search one of the bedrooms, he had heard that one of the guns might have been placed in the laundry room. Unable to control his curiosity, Petrovich checked the laundry room first. He was not disappointed in his decision. He discovered on the shelf situated above the trailer's heater a .22 caliber Smith & Wesson revolver. When he retrieved it, he saw, much to his shock and surprise, that it had a dildo attached to its barrel. When he noticed it had five live rounds of ammunition and one spent casing inside a cylinder. Over the next 90 minutes or so, Mountie searching Picton's bedroom discovered several sex toys, including fur-lined handcuffs, inside the headboard compartments of his bed. They found some items of jewelry and a purse, and in another area they discovered a notebook containing the names of the women that the missing task force have placed on their list. When Liu searched Picton's cluttered office with its untidiness, he noted that it was more orderly than other areas of the trailer. Phone book lay on top of his desk, and many of the papers were strewn about the desktop as well. Directly behind the desk, a cuckoo clock hung on the walls. Right above a large corkboard had items mostly related to the farms and the business neatly pinned to it, filling it to capacity. Was also a number of boxes stacked on the floor at one end of the room. Bags of clothing lay piled on the floor and on the wall directly to the right of the desk, assuming that one was sitting or standing behind it, hung the head of what appeared to be a light-colored stallion. The head, which is hung on the wall on the right side of the water cooler, was well-preserved, complete with a bridle. It appeared to have been stuffed and mounted by professional taxidermists, or at least by someone who knew what they were doing. An award ribbon of some type also hung to the right of the horse's head, the horse's head appearing to be staring towards the desk and appear to the casual onlooker to be some. It appeared to the casual onlooker to be more of a macabre oddity than anything else. No one knew that the head belonged to Picton's prize 1,400-pound horse, Spring Golden, which he had nicknamed Goldie. The horse, they would learn, had to be put down after it's been kicked and injured by another horse. At one point, going through the clutter in Picton's office, Lou found an asthma inhaler inside a silver sports bag laying on the floor. It has been prescribed to Serena Abbotsway. Although the name on it did not mean anything to him, Lee nonetheless called it in to Carter, sitting in a car outside the perimeter of the farm. Carter recognized Abbotsway's name as one of the missing women. He called his boss, Staff Sergeant Wayne Clary, and described the inhaler, along with the date that has been prescribed, July 19th, 2001, which was merely a few weeks before she disappeared in August of that year. The inhaler was a major find and an important piece of evidence, and both Carter and Clary recognized it as such. A few minutes after calling in the discovery, Clary ordered that the firearm search to be called off immediately. Aside of leaving guards posted outside the Picton's property line, everyone was ordered to leave. Clary instructed Carter to tell Wells that he was not to deal with Picton from that point forward. Wells was ordered not to speak to Picton and not to obtain his fingerprints. Clary scheduled a task force meeting for the next morning. Wells had left with the distinct impression that his investigation was being formally turned over to Inspector Don Adams, who would then proceed in an entirely different matter after the task force obtained its own search warrant for the Picton farm.